Too soon.
All right. Yeah, right. No, well, that was a legit sigh, man. That was,
you
that was not a... Oh,
you
my
mistimed
God.
You think
the
sigh.
Better
Hello.
At this than I am by now.
Oh, hello, everyone. Yeah. I am Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl here in my little tent fort in Los Angeles, the back room of my house. It is week what? Like, I don't know, even know how many. It's probably like week two of people starting to isolate and work from home, just like a lot of y'all are doing. And thanks for being with us. Because we're going to do the best we can with the pod this week and just talk about really important stuff.
We are. And this is, we should tell you now, for those of you who have been a little like, what is happening in my feed? Yeah, this is the regular show.
This
so,
is the actual show.
This is the regular weekly episode, the long one, the deep dive with all the feedback and all of the things. And in case you had not noticed, we are also doing a weekday shortened version of the Make Me Smart podcast, just trying to make sense of each day at a time. So keep sending questions, keep, you know, telling us what's happening with you. But this is the big
this
one.
Is this is the real
the
deal.
Tuesday show.
This is the real deal.
Staying normal for now.
Which means we're going to get back to it, right? Weekly Tuesday show stays the same. Deep dive with an expert guest, news fix, mailbag, and then the Make Me Smart question at the end. Topic of choice today is, broadly speaking, the American healthcare system, and holy cow, now what, right?
Pretty much. Yeah, I think that is pretty much the headline here. To do all of this, we have our kind of our favorite health expert on the line, Sarah Cliff, an investigative reporter for The New York Times, focusing on the American healthcare system. Sarah, thanks for coming back on Make Me Smart.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
I mean, I don't even know where to start. I think what we have been saying is that basically like testing and personal protective equipment are the two big stories. But then there's this sort of demand train headed toward us, this sort of slow motion disaster in progress. How is the U.S. healthcare system situated to meet the demands of this pandemic?
So I think the kind of short and scary answer is not especially well. And I think when you think of the American healthcare system, one of the real disadvantages it has compared to other countries is that it's very fragmented and disorganized. You know, we've talked about this before, but it's not one system. It's a ton of hospitals operating on their own, insurance companies and doctors. Unlike, you know, if you looked at like a European system, there's much more of a national government role for planning. So I feel like what we're seeing now is that doctors across the country are kind of bracing for a wave of patients they're expecting to get. In Seattle, the wave is there. In New York, the wave is getting closer. And then in other cities, it feels a little more distant, but doctors think it's going to happen. And there are just all these struggles with getting the right supplies, getting the tests, getting the ventilators. It feels like a moment when the doctors, I've been talking to a lot of emergency room doctors lately, and they feel like they're bracing for this storm, and they know that it's going to be very, very difficult to weather when it gets here.
They're bracing for a storm, or to use the president's language, this is a war, right, in which they are woefully under-equipped. If the president, and look, I don't want to get into the politics of this, although we kind of have to a little bit, but if the president did what he has said he has done, which is activate the Defense Production Act and really turn the manufacturing base of this country to personal protective equipment and ventilators and all of the stuff that these people say they need, would that... How much would that help the problem, I guess? Because the problem is going to be huge in any case.
Yeah. So it's a little hard to know, given that we've never tried to do anything like this. There isn't really good precedent to look back at. That being said, I've been talking to people about this exact issue. You know, can you take carve manufacturing lines and other industrial factories and turn them over to personal protective equipment and ventilators? The answer seems to be closer to yes when you think about things like surgical masks, which are relatively easy to manufacture. The answer might not be quite as close to yes when you think of something like a ventilator, which is a complex machine. I just learned from one of the large ventilator manufacturers, I was talking to the head of their North American business the other day, their machine has 1,750 parts in it. So that is a big thing to make. It's specialized. They have workers in those factories who have been trained to build these machines. And it's not like you can just drop these ventilators off at a hospital. You need someone to install them, someone to train the staff. So I think for the simpler things, the protective equipment that we're really hearing medical workers clamor for, that kind of stuff can be made a little bit easier. But when the ventilators, which are going to become another bottleneck, we've already seen that in Italy, those, there's more questions. And I think for all of this, one of the things you can run into our supply chain issues, where, you know, one of the really simple devices we've seen come into shortage is the nasal swab that is used in the test. It turns out the main company that manufactures these nasal swabs is based in Northern Italy. So that has created...
It just
shows how interconnected all of this is. And even something as simple as a nasal swab, that can be difficult to manufacture when you're in a global pandemic situation.
How
big a deal would activating that Defense Protection Act be in terms of sort of the easing, like, I guess, some of the business concerns? I mean, hospitals have increasingly, and apparently grocery stores too, I learned recently, you know, they've been operating on this just-in-time kind of maximum efficiency model of only keeping on hand what they think they need in that exact moment.
Right.
And now you hear some companies saying, well, we don't want to make too many ventilators because then we'd be stuck with them. How do we over, you know, would the Defense Protection Act activation overcome some of those economic hurdles?
I think it would certainly help. And I mean, one of the things you're seeing right now is I've been talking to a lot of ventilator manufacturers. That's kind of what I've been reporting on the past week. And they just can't keep up with demand. So I don't think they're quite as worried. I think you're right, Molly, that before the pandemic, ventilators were something you didn't really stockpile. You know, these devices cost $25,000 to $40,000. So it's not like a hospital can afford to just keep a bunch of them in a back room and not use them. Now it seems like the demand is certainly there. And I think there isn't as much concern about whether the demand will stay there. Unfortunately, it seems like the situation is getting worse, both in our country and in a lot of other countries. So there does seem to be a demand to purchase these units. The question is, you know, how quickly can you flip over the manufacturing lines? Can you train the staff? Another thing that ventilator manufacturers are running into is they're being asked to bring a lot of people into these factories right at a moment when we're all trying to socially distance. So that creates its own kind of hurdles. You need protective equipment for your factory workers. You need, you know, one ventilator manufacturer out in Seattle is doing temperature checks on every worker who comes into the factory. You know, the last thing you'd want is an outbreak of coronavirus among ventilator manufacturing workers. So I think the demand side, that's kind of being answered naturally, but the supplying side still faces a lot of hurdles.
Can we back out for a second to the, wait for this pun, you ready? The pre-existing conditions of the American healthcare system before this whole thing started, right? Come on, even in a crisis,
It is both great and terrible. I will allow that.
The number of uninsured in this healthcare economy is huge. You've been doing some reporting on the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, which turned 10 like this week or something. How much is that exacerbating the situation because of the uncertainty about who's going to pay for tests, who's going to pay for care? And I get that a lot of this is in flux with the bill that's floating around on Capitol Hill today, too.
Right.
But some context, I think, matters.
Yeah, so I think it's certainly, again, this is something that's pretty different about our healthcare system than the European ones that are also battling coronavirus outbreaks, is that Americans have kind of become accustomed to worrying about big medical bills. I've talked to folks who just don't like to go to the emergency room because they've had a big medical bill in their past. And so even if you have legislation that says, okay, we're going to cover the costs, there's kind of this way of thinking that's been ingrained in our system that you don't go unless you're really sick. I've interviewed some folks who had really big bills for flu and asked them, you know, would you go if you had those kind of symptoms? And some of them said, you know, no, I would try and weather it at home. And again, this is exactly how this virus is going to spread. If you have a lot of people not seeking treatment, still seeing friends and family while they are, you know, staying home and not seeking treatment for coronavirus, the coronavirus pandemic is really going to test the Affordable Care Act in some really interesting ways. It seems like you guys are the economic experts more than I am, but it seems like we are headed into a recession. And this will be the Affordable Care Act's first recession, the first time we've had Medicaid expansion, the first time we've had expanded access to individual market insurance. So in a way, the Affordable Care Act certainly leaves some holes with those 20 million uninsured, but it's really providing a safety net that we haven't had in any previous recession. And we're going to see how that plays out in the next few months and years.
Let's dig into that a little bit more. I think I did see that some states are going to expand the sign-up window. Is that right? for the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah. 11 states are now saying people can sign. They've reopened open enrollment. Usually it's just open in the fall. But right now they feel like it's important enough to open it up if people are uninsured, you know, worried about possible medical bills. So we've been seeing that happen in a few states. The Wall Street Journal reported over the weekend that the federal government is considering opening the enrollment window on healthcare.gov, yeah, which serves a large number of states that would give people the opportunity to enroll. But I think the thing that's actually going to matter even more is Medicaid expansion. You have a lot of people being laid off, a lot of people losing jobs right now. And with no income, they become eligible for Medicaid expansion in the states that have participated in that program. So one of the things I'm really interested to watch is how that plays out and what disparities you see between states. You know, Florida and Texas, huge populations, they don't have Medicaid expansion. So it's a very, very different situation health insurance-wise to get laid off in Florida than to get laid off in New York, where you can go sign up for public health insurance. Mm-hmm.
So that raises sort of the other question about insurance, which is that, you know, there are plenty of people who are flat out uninsured, some who are enrolled in the ACA, and then, of course, the many, many, many millions who get their health insurance through work. So even sort of like with Medicaid expansion in some states, is it going to be enough if we have massive job loss?
Sure.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think it's something that's going to, you know, be a budgetary question, too, of how many people can we afford to have on the Medicaid rolls? And is this causing, you know, some kind of tension for states? Right now, states have to pay about 10% of their Medicaid expansion bills. So that's, you know, that number gets a lot bigger when you have more people on Medicaid and when your economy isn't as strong and you're bringing in a smaller state budget. You know, one other issue I think about, two, is the fact that deductibles have been rising a lot in the past few years. You see this particularly on the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, where the deductibles, you know, are in the range of $6,000 for an individual. They can be up to $13,000 for a family. So that's a pretty big gap in coverage as well. You could have people who are gaining insurance but are still getting thousands of dollars of bills. So it feels a little glass half empty, glass half full. The safety net is certainly stronger than it was before the Affordable Care Act, but there are still a lot of ways to get stuck with a big medical bill, either for coronavirus treatment or for something totally unrelated.
Right.
Hmm. I get, before I let you go, I'm just asking all the questions. Before I let you go, I have
we are
speaking
with, you know,
to you. Okay, good. Anytime you want to talk, Kai, you just hop right in.
I'm all right.
We are talking to you at this moment when there is sort of this rising, these two competing narratives. Like, you have health experts on one side saying we need to continue suppression efforts to flatten the curve. You have economic experts and many Republicans saying we need to figure out a way to open up the economy so we don't suffer long-term damage. What are you hearing from the health expert side of things?
Yeah, so they really want to keep the social distancing strong. They feel like it would be a mistake to start going back to work at this point because, you know, especially if you look at places like New York, Washington State, these outbreaks are pretty active and healthcare workers are pretty worried about getting overwhelmed by too many coronavirus cases. So I think when I talk to the public health experts, they still think it is doing the right thing, even though it is challenging. You know, I'm working from home with a toddler. It's not the easiest situation to be working in. And certainly my productivity is down and a lot of Americans' productivity is down, but they still feel like it is worth that trade-off. You know, I think there's a question that you see coming up, is the cure worse than the disease? And public health experts still seem to say no, the cure is better than what the disease could look like if it got really bad.
Sarah Cliff is an investigative reporter at the New York Times, does a lot of healthcare and healthcare policy stuff. Always really good to talk to you, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah.
Stay safe. Yeah, I mean,
yep.
What do you even say after all this stuff? It's just, so let's see what tomorrow brings, shall we? Right? I mean, you know, yeah. Right?
Well, yeah, I because my friends are all nerds, we've been passing around the same photo of Jean-Luc Picard in the captain's chair because it's like waking up every single day in the coronavirus era is basically just us being Picard saying damage report every morning.
I was going to ask for the explainer, but
damage report.
For the, oh, my God.
Yep.
You're a dork.
Also,
you're just a huge
side
nerd.
Note, yeah, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. What? You know, I believe, I'm just in a segue, tangent for a second. I believe that in some ways I am slightly more mentally prepared for this because I have read so much sci-fi. Like, I'm totally like, oh, I know, I can see the pattern recognition, you know, or the patterns coming. And granted, then that sometimes takes me down rabbit holes that freak me out. But I'm just saying, sci-fi can be our guide.
No, I think that's probably true. I think that's probably true. Look, and you are the more expansive and creative thinker of the two of us. I am much more straight ahead and rigid. And this is outside our normal experience. And so, I mean, I think you're right. It probably makes more sense that you are having, while we're all troubled, you are perhaps a touch less troubled than, you know, those of us who think straight ahead.
Or like maybe more horribly troubled because, you know, all the sci-fi books end in disaster. Maybe. Well, okay, maybe not all. Anyway.
Anyway.
We're going to take a quick break.
Yes, we are.
In the meantime, please do us a favor and check out the Daily Podcast. If you're already subscribed to Make Me Smart, it should be in your feed. And apologies if you're annoyed by it. I hope you like it. And if you like it, tell a friend to subscribe to Make Me Smart.
Yeah. And if you are annoyed, by the way, tell us that too.
I mean, really, keep it coming. We've already had a lot of people say, like, I want it to have its own feed, which, you know.
Oh, I'm not even going to forget that.
1 million things at a time, friends.
Coming back. Look at that. We did it without anybody prompting us. How about that?
We're back.
Let's do the news fix. Molly goes first because she's listed first in the rundown. You know what I'm noticing, by the way? Sorry, wait.
Yeah.
I have to ramble here for a minute. So I'm doing a COVID goatee, as viewers of this video will know.
I can't even wait to see this.
It's so terrible. And and it's making me touch my face more because I'm scratching. So I'm going to have to shave.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's not good,
friend. Look, I just washed my hands. But come on, well, I'm never going to experiment like this again. It's like a freebie now because I can't go out in public and have people say, what are you doing? You look terrible.
I mean, this is where, like, I have to confess that I haven't really ever sat and watched one of our entire videos because I do feel like that would be a little weird. But, I mean, I can't wait to see this week's now. I have to know. I also, I had a friend today suggest a name for the period that we're going through.
Yes.
The kind of like the social distancing period, which I want to acknowledge, by the way. I realize we're all talking about it like everybody's doing it. But it's really just a few states.
That's the thing.
And I think we have to really acknowledge, like, we keep saying week two.
Yep.
Some states are not even, don't have any. We have shelter in place, which is actually more restrictive. I think that only exists in California and New York, right?
All right,
maybe in Washington.
Let's just do the call out here, right? And I don't want to call anybody out, as it were, but if your state is not sheltering in place or your community is not taking this seriously, let us know. Make me smart at marketplace.org because that is bananas. And look, if you live in Florida and you live by the beach, just don't.
But yeah, tell us what you are hearing from your states. And I, you know, and it's not, I mean, I will say, like, my mom is in North Dakota. My dad is in Montana. Certainly in North Dakota, the state officials have taken it incredibly seriously. They got one confirmed case, and the governor was on TV with all the mayors just being like, nope, everybody go home. So it's, you know, we shouldn't say, but in terms of this, like, shelter in place where we're all, like, trying to reconfigure our work lives, I would say we should acknowledge that's not totally universal, which is interesting. Anyway, he suggested that we need a name for the era that we're in, the kind of shutdown. And he says that we should call it the sequester, which I thought was kind of interesting.
It kind of is, but for business and economic reporters, it brings up memories of sequestration and then a whole budget act that McCain got going, or he didn't get it going, but he criticized it for the defense. I don't think I want to go there.
Oh, look, that's when you became a dork. You just had a dork moment.
I've always been a dork, just a different kind of dork.
Econ dorks are like, no. Okay, all right. Well, then in that case, we are taking suggestions because I saw the Great Cessation and that was really dark. I saw a piece in the... So I will confess that yesterday, Monday, because we're literally living our lives minute by minute right now, I went to the dark place over the discourse and the idea that, you know, it started to feel certainly in the Twitter bubble, like one side was arguing that we're just going to have to let people die so we can get back to business. And then the other side was arguing, you're a bunch of monsters because I can't believe you want to let people die and you've completely sacrificed the moral, blah, blah, blah. And so I'd slept badly on it. And this is what I came to this morning. And actually, ironically, the New Republic has an article somewhat to this effect. This is a false equivalency. Like, Asian democracies have managed to enact serious suppression measures combined with financial support that has not necessarily caused their economies to, like, tank for the long term. So if we're framing this as we have to sacrifice the elderly, which, and like, by the way, throw in all the medical workers who don't have personal protective equipment because it's not being made for them or isn't available. All of the young, the people between 40 and 60 who have high infection rates and lots of hospitalization and are also a 36-year-old Brooklyn principal, school principal, died from this yesterday.
Yep.
So A, that is a false equivalency. But even if the argument is, like, there have to be some sacrifices so that young people can have an economic future, that is also false. There is no evidence that this will cause, for example, a permanent economic collapse. And also, this country, as we've seen from the fact that the Fed just created $1.5 trillion to backstop banks in the form of credit, we have the money. We have the money to support this country through the amount of time that it will take us to suppress the spread of this virus, which we actually can track and we know is about 2 to 3 months. And so I just need everybody on Twitter to stop yelling about what monsters they are. Like, liberals need to stop taking the bait about the death panels and the this and that. And then conservatives need to stop arguing that somehow we're like, we have to sacrifice the old to save the young. Like, all of that is untrue. We have the money. We have not yet even started to try to address this problem for real in a way that will save all the lives and save the economy. Right now, everybody's just yelling. Like, I'm having a Grandma Pat moment here. This is my, like, tough German grandmother who never sat down, never stopped drinking black coffee, and never stopped working. Like, everybody, make yourself useful or get out of the way.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my news fix. And also, I'm taking the day off Twitter.
There you go. I will add only this. I don't know what the actual number is, because we're on the same page with what the news fix of the day is. This idea of opening back up the economy. I don't know what the actual number is of people who might die, who wouldn't otherwise die if this economy opens back up again, as the president and his advisors are talking about. There's a cost to dead people, too.
Yeah, and right? Sick people.
Right. And we just need to acknowledge that. That's it. That's all I'm going to say.
Right.
That's all I mean,
there's
say.
A real moral cost. Okay, I'll stop. Fine. I hear you.
Message. Message transmitted. Message received. You betcha. You betcha. All right. Well, look, that got dark in a hurry, and it was not me. I'm just pointing out. But with that, we will bring the news fix to a close. Sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter, please. Every Friday, a little bit of news, more smart stuff you can share at Zoom Happy Hour, which, parenthetically, I just don't get the whole Zoom Happy Hour thing. That's like drinking by yourself,
what,
but
really?
Saying it's not by yourself. Yeah, what is that?
Look, we're having one.
Do we need to get into the whole social thing differences between you and me? I don't think we do.
We're having a Zoom happy hour tonight. Boy, after the daily, instead of the daily pod.
No, we can't. I got
you're hilarious.
To do, man. And also, it's drinking so on a school night. How do you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning if you're drinking on school night? Anyway, make me smart at marketplace.org is where you send your voice memos or your emails if you want to get in touch with us. Marketplace.org/newsletters is where you go to subscribe.
You know, you don't have to drink, right? Like, you can just have a LaCroix. You can have a mocktail. Last night I had a Mexi-Coke.
Is that the mailbox thing
Hi,
I hear?
Hi,
yes,
Molly.
It is the mailbox thing I hear.
Right. This is Rebecca.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in
Saved
my vote.
By the
I want
sting.
To discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
So Jeff wrote to us, actually sent us a voice memo. We're not using his last name because he works in purchasing, as it happens, at a big grocery store chain, and he is not authorized to speak for the company. Does want to let us know that when it comes to groceries and the shortages we have all been seeing, everybody just relax for a second. Here's Jeff.
Hey, Make Me Smart team. I wanted to add some perspective to the questions and fears about shortages at the grocery stores. In short, we have food, but we just can't get it to the stores fast enough. More than anything else, the panic buying is taxing our distribution network of trucks, trailers, drivers, selectors at the warehouse. And because of that shortage, we're limiting the amount of product each store can order, which means it'll just take longer to get each store filled back up again. Another point to illustrate that we have food is we're getting calls from the largest restaurant distributors asking if they can deliver product to us since restaurants are no longer ordering. We're in discussions with them on how to make that happen. Prior to this crisis, more than 50% of dollars spent on food was spent at restaurants. This has completely upended the way that consumers eat, and it will take time for the grocery industry to adapt.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. This has been your thing for a couple of days now, right? Sorry.
It has been my thing. And, you know, listen, it's stressing people out. Like, it's stressing people out to go to stores and see things not on shelves and try to figure out where to get stuff. And it's, you know, it's a time to get creative. It is really interesting because it goes back to that sort of just-in-time efficiency thing. The Wall Street Journal had a great story about how, you know, in the interest of maximizing efficiency and therefore margins and profits, like, stores used to keep months worth of food on hand and now haven't. But I got to say, you guys, there are a lot of creative solutions to this. Like, I signed up for a CSA box because the agriculture...
Wait,
like,
what's the CSA? People who would,
it's a community service agriculture, I think.
Oh, okay.
And it's like basically veggie subscription. And so a lot of the farmers that would otherwise be at farmers markets are... I mean, these boxes have already always existed, but you just get... Now they're like, please sign up for my box delivery so that my veggies don't go bad. So you can get fresh vegetables and sometimes fruit delivered at home. Restaurants are selling at wholesale prices. We just got a fish delivery that I split with another family. Like, there's, anyway, there is food, but I think like the fact that it's adding to the panic and it's causing people to buy more because they're going in and they're having this like scarcity response. And so
that's exactly
don't
right.
go to the that's don't exactly go right. to the store. Eat the frozen stuff in your fridge. I know you have it.
Eat the frozen stuff, and then when you go to the store, don't buy 14 of something. Buy a little bit beyond what you need, and then stockpile. That's, I mean, right? Do that over time.
Just buy like
that's the way to do
one
it.
Day extra.
Right.
Yeah, it's gonna be okay, everyone. All right, our next one comes from listener Karen LeVay. Heads up, it's adorable. I love people and their ingenuity. It is really amazing. She says, I want to suggest a possible angle to the benefits of online communities. I retired about 18 months ago and since then moved to another state, so my social network has to be rebuilt. I also resumed a hobby of quilting, joining the 7 to 10 million quilters in the U.S. The quilting community, both locally through the Quilting Guild and online through a variety of Facebook and Instagram groups, has just been so helpful for me. She says, currently many quilting instructors are running quilt alongs. These are a regular part of the quilting world, but now there are special ones in this time of social distancing. And many people in the quilting community are part of the at-risk generation. This ability to have some type of interaction is really good for us. Most of us have the materials needed to continue to produce warm, cozy products or modern art projects and to share our progress with one another online. Thought this might be an interesting take on how social networking is helping. Aww.
Yeah, so I think that's good. And look, I know I said I wasn't down for Zoom happy hours, and I get that. But I will tell you that on whatever it was, Tuesday-ish of – so Tuesday last week, we did our first Marketplace production, you know, the afternoon show, the Marketplace production staff meeting on Zoom after not having seen everybody for 4 or 5 days. It was nice to see faces. It was nice. It was a little soothing, which was great.
It is.
Because these are not soothing times.
I would really like to see, actually. So my son's grandmother has been giving him Spanish lessons over Zoom in the afternoon.
Wow.
And because they used to hang out every Wednesday, like it's a way for them to keep in touch. But honestly, I think that platform could exist because a lot of seniors are very isolated right now, like upsettingly so.
Yep.
And a lot of kids are at home in need of company and also education. And a lot of people, I mean, I'm just like, somebody, dear Silicon Valley nerds, like, build this platform so that seniors can educate kids. Like, let's make that happen. It benefits everybody. Make it
for
go.
Sure.
Make
for
it
sure.
Make it so, as Captain Picard would say.
Oh God, you are consistent. Anyway, all right. A firsthand story now of somebody who survived coronavirus. His name is Dan. He's in Brooklyn, New York. Also, by the way, full disclosure, he's a friend of our producer Sam Anderson. So here's Dan from Brooklyn.
Hi, my name is Daniel Goldstein. I'm a 27-year-old healthy male currently living in Brooklyn, New York. About 12 days ago, I noticed a wave of exhaustion sweep over me. Didn't think anything of it until I woke up at 5 in the morning that night with chills and a general sense of being unwell. I went back to sleep, and when I woke up, the symptoms really came in hard. I'm talking shortness of breath, full body aches, fever, chills, a headache like you wouldn't imagine. So I decided to call my doctor. She advised that I should get to an urgent care center. So I did, and there I got tested. Anyway, I went home and self-quarantined as I was instructed. Soon the symptoms came back harder than ever, and the shortness of breath had really intensified. This, coupled with anxiety, caused me to call my doctor. She told me that I should get to an ER as soon as I could. So I did, and I was put in a room with basically people with sprained shoulders and whatnot. Finally, the doctor came, told me that my lungs were fine and my vitals were okay, that I could go home. I went home, slept, and during the night, my fever broke. I woke up absolutely drenched in sweat. The symptoms mostly subsided from there on out. I still have a lingering shortness of breath. The exhaustion took a few days. Aside from that, though, I have all but recovered. Young people, this is serious. Do not take it lightly. Let's do our part to keep everyone safe.
27 years old.
God, you can still hear it. Yeah.
Otherwise healthy. Yeah, you can hear the lingering shortness of breath, right?
Yeah, you really can. No, it sounds like this thing is absolutely brutal. When it comes on strong, it sounds just brutal, which is... Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad he's okay. And thanks, Sam, for getting your friend to call us and tell us that story. All right, we will finish up today with the Make Me Smart question. This week's answer comes from listener Morgan Layla. It is related to last week's show about school closings and remote learning.
Hi, Molly and Kai. I finally have an answer to the Make Me Smart question. I used to think that I could never teach students with emotional behavior disorders remotely. I used to make jokes that my job could never be done from home. Well, with this new reality, I was wrong. I can, and I'm learning right along with my students. And although it's new and different, it's exciting, and we're enjoying it. And I'm glad that I can keep a connection to those students who need the most support. I look forward to this all being over, but for now, it's small silver lining to see their smiling faces. Thanks for everything.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing to see a time when people are like, go teachers, or rather go grocery store workers, right? Go delivery drivers, and of course, go healthcare workers, but also there are a lot of teachers working their butts off. My sister-in-law is one of them, and it is really, it's incredible to see what they're pulling off.
It's tough.
Yep, love it.
Okay, so on the way out here, let's see. A couple of things. Number one, make me smart at marketplace.org. Number two, marketplace.org/newsletters. Also, Molly and I do the smart speaker thing. Lots of COVID-19 stuff on it now. Social distancing, video conferencing, all that stuff. I won't say the name, but tell your thing to make you smart and it'll play stuff for you. And then you'll learn things.
It will. It will. We're here for you guys. We are here for you with a steady stream of free content accessible to all that we hope is helping.
Except please support your local public radio station. Also, Make Me Smart Daily, Monday, 4 days a week anyway, because this one on Tuesdays is enough.
Yeah. I'm exhausted just hearing all of this. We couldn't do it without the team we're about to talk about.
That was really good.
Oh, Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, writing a ton of content. Our senior producer is Jody Becker, keeping all the planes in the air. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, our video intern, Ethan Peretz, and writer-producer, Erica Phillips, who writes all those Alexa explainers and the newsletter.
She does indeed.
Oh, no,
this week's program
it.
Was in what? Oh, that's all right. You got the
A word.
It's not gonna trigger, I'm telling you. If it triggers, write to us. Make Me Smarter, Mark.
Sorry, guys.
This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. That's the way we've got to say it now. The executive director of On Demand is Star Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Bye, guys. Good show.
All right. Bye.
You know, maybe instead of the sequester, we call this the bent holiday. Maybe we just lean in.
It's a bent holiday?
The bent holiday.
I like that.
Right?
Nobody outside our little circle is going to know that, but whatever.
They won't, but the ones who do get it are really going to get it.
Are really going to get it. That's the insider thing.
Here we are on day 11 of the bent holiday.
Yep.